MechCast, Sunday, November 5th, 2017. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, quite a week has gone on this week because we are past November 3rd, that magic date when Apple has started shipping the iPhone X. So needless to say, this episode of the MacCast is going to be a little bit of iPhone X heavy, although we do have a few other things to talk about. We're going to be getting into more of Apple's plans for potential future iPhones beyond the iPhone X. We're going to talk about some more of their original content stuff. They've been hiring more people this week, believe it or not. We're going to talk about iOS cameras and privacy and a little issue possibly with the new Apple Watch. And we also have Apple's fourth quarter results that came in this past week. So have those things to talk about. A little follow-up on our Apple TV, HDR 4K stuff that we've been talking about over the last few episodes. And then I'm going to share with you my first impressions of my iPhone X. And I have some iPhone X tips and tricks for those of you who are lucky enough to have an iPhone X, or maybe those of you who will be getting an iPhone X soon. And then we're going to talk about live photos, and that should round out this episode of the MacCast. So it should be a lot of fun, but before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Squarespace. You know, I love Squarespace. I've used Squarespace many, many times. If you need a website or you want something put up that is quick, easy, it's going to look totally awesome, and something you can do possibly in minutes, depending upon the complexity of your site, then you want Squarespace. What I love about Squarespace and why I like to use them is you get everything from a single source. So the domain, the hosting, professional, mobile-ready, responsive designs, access to all of the good things you need, social media integration, analytics, a whole bunch more. It's all on a single great platform with Squarespace. And best of all, they have awesome customer service. So if you get in trouble, they will help you out. And I've used them to create quick websites to promote events and meetups that I've done for the MacCast. And look, I'm a web developer. Yeah, I could have gone in and built all this stuff myself and set up a server and done all that stuff. But who wants that complexity, especially when you don't need to have it? Squarespace gives it all to you, and you can get something up that looks great, is fast, and they are perfect for that. They have templates for all kinds of websites, no matter what you might need. So if you're an artist, a designer, a photographer, you want a portfolio website, they've got templates for that. If you're a writer or a blogger, you want to start putting your ideas out on the web, they can do that for you too. If you maybe want to set up something for your wedding or an event that's coming up, they make it really easy. How about a sports team that you run, or maybe a club that you've organized? They can help you get a website up for that too. And because they have all kinds of add-ons, things they call blocks for things like maps and galleries and social media integration, audio, video, whatever you might want to throw on your website, it's there, and you can adapt and customize the design to really meet your needs. So you can really personalize it. And plus, if you're a guy like me and you know coding and you want to do advanced things, they have ways for you to do that as well. So you can get in there and you can do it all. So what I want you to do is check out squarespace.com. You can get a free trial. Just try it out. See if it'll work for you. I know it will. So just try it out. And when you're ready to launch, you can use the code MACCAST, M-A-C-C-A-S-T, to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. So go to squarespace.com, get your free trial now. You're going to love it. And a big thank you to Squarespace for their support of the MacCast. I guess it was just about a week ago that the iPhone X went on pre-sale. Unfortunately, I think I did the MacCast right before the 27th, which was the pre-sale date. So we really haven't talked about that yet. So that's kind of where I want to start the episode today. Ordering, I think, went well for most people. Apple started taking orders at 12. I got in about 12:02 a.m. Pacific time. There was a little bit of a delay, as there always is. And I was on Twitter. I was talking and chatting with many of you who were also, you know, waiting with bated breath to get our pre-orders in. We were all wondering, is there going to be enough stock? How is that going to go? And I would say overall, for most people, it seemed like it went pretty well. I know there was some hiccups and some challenges for some of you out there, and I felt bad about that. But overall, I think people were able to get their orders in. And actually, I got some audio feedback from Gene, and here was kind of his experience.
Hi, Adam. I thought you'd like to hear some experiences with regard to recent orders for the iPhone X. I logged into the Apple Web Store and the AT&T account somewhere around midnight and saw that both sites were down, saying that they were preparing for orders to be placed for the iPhone X. I left those websites up on my laptop and watched some TV and then set about listening to some podcasts and started your podcast timed to end roughly around the 3 a.m. Ordering time for us here on the East Coast. I'll admit to lightly dozing off while I was listening to your podcast simply because it was so late, but was jarred fully awake at about 5 minutes to 3 a.m. by a chime, which turned out to be from the AT&T website asking if I was still there and wanted to enter an order. Clicked the buttons, 1, 2, 3, had my order in for my iPhone X in about, I would say, less than a minute, and had confirmation that I was going to receive it sometime on November 3rd. We'll see how that plays out, but I was completely surprised at how quick the process was and painless, and we'll see whether the supply meets the demand at that point. Anyway, thanks for a great podcast. I've been listening to you since pretty close to the beginning of when you started doing it, that's the report from Waterbury, Connecticut.
So that was Gene's experience, and I have to say it was pretty indicative of the experience I think most people had. I also noted that many of you chose to order directly from the carrier, and that seemed to go pretty well for most carriers, and that kind of falls in line with the poll, the little poll I asked you about on the last episode of the MacCast, where we covered the story about where people buy their iPhones from, and a surprising number of you actually get them from the carrier stores. For Apple's website, I got mixed reports this year. It was interesting. Some people actually were able to get into Apple's online store quicker than they were able to get into the store app. Now, I personally use the store app. I was able to get in. It seemed like it went live for me about 12:02 a.m., so about 2 minutes after the scheduled start time for pre-orders. And I had my order in within 2 minutes, but I received a delivery date, an estimated delivery date of between November 11th and to the 17th. And it got me a little bit frustrated because I started seeing people reporting, putting in orders for the exact same model. I ordered the Space Gray 256 gigabyte model. I saw people getting orders for that were placed later than mine, getting launch dates of November 3rd or ship dates of November 3rd. And I was a little bit puzzled by that. And I think a lot of us were. It turned out it looks like there was maybe a computer glitch or something with the allocation specifically for T-Mobile models here in the States. And I was actually over the weekend after placing my order did get bumped up to a November 3rd ship date. So I'm not sure what was going on. But carrier stores seemed to have orders available for November 3rd shipping much later than even Apple. Quickly, Apple's website started reporting ship dates a week out and then 2 to 3 weeks out, and ultimately landed at about 5 to 6 weeks out, about 30 minutes or so after ordering started. The good news was is that many people seemed to be able to get in-store pickup for November 3rd, and Apple actually came out with an announcement, I think right around launch time, saying that they were going to have in-store stock available on launch day, something they have not really had available in a long time. It was always pre-orders, and you could maybe pick it up at the Apple Store, but this time around, they were bringing people back into the Apple Stores, and I was really happy to see that as a change. And we'll talk more a little bit about how those lines looked on launch day here in a second, but After the pre-sales went off, Apple did make a public statement saying that iPhone X response was, quote, off the charts. And it does seem that the supply constraints that we were worried about didn't seem to be much of a factor. You remember Tim Cook has always said, never trust what you hear from the supply chain. And I think this launch has kind of proven that out, because it doesn't seem like orders are down. You might assume, well, because stock is still available and you can get stock at the Apple store if you're really lucky, it's still difficult to get your hands on an iPhone X. But we didn't see shipping dates or delivery dates slip into 2018 quickly like we thought we would. So it seems like Apple is really caught up with demand in the supply chain, but demand is still really, really high. All indicators seem to indicate that the iPhone X is going to be a huge success. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in the numbers. It's also playing out that the iPhone 8 and 8 Plus seem to be selling very well. So when we get into Apple's quarterly numbers a little bit later, we'll get into that. But let's move on to launch day. November 3rd comes around, and most deliveries seemed to go very, very smoothly. My experience was good. I was actually able to use UPS's new Track My Delivery feature, which is pretty cool. If you get certain shipping from UPS and you're part of their My Choice program, which is free to sign up for, they have a new feature where you can actually watch in real time GPS the truck move around your neighborhood. So it was kind of cool, also a little bit nerve-wracking, because he showed up in my neighborhood very early in the day, probably around 10 a.m., and then I watched him bounce around, going completely past me two or three times, and before I realized, well, they're actually doing the commercial deliveries to the businesses around my house before they actually go do the residential deliveries, which makes sense. I think they have a commitment to deliver commercial deliveries by about 11:30 a.m. But watching that was kind of fun and a little bit stressful at the same time. But did finally get my iPhone X, and I was able to activate it without too much trouble. I did have to call my carrier when I did my activation, and there were a number of reports of people having activation issues. So there was some frustration on launch day with many of you getting your iPhones and then going to set them up and finding out that Apple's servers were overloaded. And you would think by now they would have had that sorted out, but nope, we're still there. I think, you know, internet and servers and demand, again, another indicator that demand was probably really, really huge for the iPhone X launch. But as I was saying, many people decided and opted to go to an Apple store to wait in line. There were all kinds of pictures showing up, and thank you to everybody who sent me pictures of the lines at their local Apple retail stores. I got emails from many of you all over the world, and it seemed typically like there were hundreds of people waiting in line, either for picking up their iPhone or also just trying to get their hands on an iPhone X on launch day. And I'm glad that experience is back. I may have to start reviving the in-line interviews I used to do in the old days here on the MacCast now that that's happening again. And I'm super excited about that. As far as how things are now, if you want to get your hands on an iPhone X, it looks like shipping times seem to be improving in most areas of the world, about 3 to 4 weeks if you were to try to order one today. There also does seem to still be in-store availability. If you get lucky, Apple is advising show up to the store early if you want to try and get your hands on a phone. I would also advise maybe checking the online store or the app the night before and see if you can get in-store pickup. I was able to look just last night, and there was one 64 gigabyte iPhone X available at one of the local Apple retail stores near me. So I could have ordered it and scheduled it for pickup the next day. And if I remember right, I think the best time to check is about 9 or 10 p.m. The night before. So your local time, right around when the Apple store closes, they get stock in, and I think they start restocking the computers or putting that information in when they receive it and making those available for sale overnight. So try overnight the night before, and that may give you some luck. And Apple is allowing for pre-sale in-store pickup via its stores in many parts of the world, the US, UK, Australia, Belgium, Canada, Hong Kong, Mexico, Switzerland, and the UAE. And I think in many of those countries, they're also doing the reserve and pickup option, which I think you don't even have to put in a credit card. It kind of gives you a 30-minute window to show up at the Apple store, you set a pickup time, and if you show up within that window, you can pay for the device right in the store. If you miss that window, though, they will sell it off to another customer. So yeah, you do have to be on time. Don't be late if you've set it up that way. Or again, just pay in advance online and set up an in-store pickup. But overall, it's been great. I'm going to give you some of my thoughts and impressions on the iPhone X a little bit later. A few other things to note about the iPhone X launch. We're getting reports that out-of-warranty replacement costs are going to be quite a bit more. So if you haven't purchased AppleCare Plus coverage in the past and you're getting an iPhone X, you may want to consider it. It really just depends on how good you are with your devices. But the cost for a replacement screen right now from Apple, if you don't have an AppleCare Plus warranty, is going to be about $279 US. And any other damage to the phone outside of that is going to run you about $549 US for a full replacement. If you have AppleCare Plus coverage, though, it's going to be $29 for a screen replacement. That's the deductible for up to two incidents. Any other damage is $99 US for that deductible. Of course, that is going to cost you $200 up front. So you kind of have to do the math on that, weigh the pluses and minuses. But just be aware, component parts for this, because they're all brand new, new technologies for Apple, they are a little bit more expensive. Of course, iFixit also got their hands on an iPhone X. I think they go to Australia actually a day ahead of most of us to get it, or I guess those of us here in the U.S. I shouldn't say most of us. There's a lot of you down there in Australia and New Zealand. But they head down there, they fly someone out, they get their hands on a phone, and of course they immediately then go tear it down, rip it apart, so we can see just how gorgeous it is on the inside. And I have to say, it's just as beautiful on the inside. They've done a really amazing design job with this iPhone, and they've kind of had to. They got to pack everything in a very confined space, but it's all very well organized. Some of the new things that they've noted with this design that are different than past designs, there is two battery cells, or there are two battery cells kind of in an L configuration to kind of get everything to fit in where Apple needs it to fit in. It's a much smaller logic board, although it has more components on it, and the way they achieved that is iFixit says they actually really kind of just folded the logic board in half and soldered the two pieces together. So all the components packed really tightly in there. They also noted that there's a reinforced lightning connector, so maybe that'll help with some of the connection failure issues that can sometimes happen as an iPhone gets older. And then one other thing they noted was a quote-unquote mystery chip that was between the haptic engine and the lower speaker. They did a little more investigating, and that turned out to be a Broadcom touch screen controller chip. Overall, they gave it a repairability score of 6 out of 10. Actually, not too bad for an iPhone, and considering how packed and glued everything was, I'm surprised they gave it even that high of a repairability score. But you know, most of us aren't going to be digging into the internals of our iPhone X. We're just going to be totally loving it and using it. Now, many people have questions about the new OLED display and that technology, especially in light of some of the issues the Pixel 2 XL has been having. Apple did note that the OLED technology is different than their current LCD technology, and you could notice possible color shifts and visual changes. You can kind of read that as burn-in or screen issues, and this is just something that is part of OLED technology, and the burn-in is only supposed to happen with extended long-term use if you have your device really bright. Basically, OLED displays, they have a couple of differences from traditional IPS LCD screens that we have been used to with iPhones. If you view them off angle, and I've seen this on my own iPhone X now, there's kind of a blue color shift. It's even more noticeable if you're using Apple's True Tone display technology. And Apple engineers have reportedly taken really great steps to try to avoid the issue of burn-in or image persistence with the OLED, but it still possibly could happen in some scenarios. So Apple is saying right up front, hey, you may see this happening. What they really recommend is that you avoid displaying any static images on the display at a maximum brightness for long periods of time. Now, luckily, most of the time, what you're going to see with OLED panels is not burn-in, just image persistence, and you can usually do some things to actually make that go away. And so if that's the case, it's going to be turn out to be kind of a minor annoyance. There is also, though, the possibility of permanent image burn-in in some scenarios. It sounds like the iPhone's not going to suffer from it like some other devices that we've heard about recently, but only time is going to tell on that. So, you know, people just got their hands on the iPhone X and the OLED display this week. We're going to have to wait and see how things play out. But according to Apple, they've tried very hard to make sure they don't fall victim to some of the other issues. And one of the things about the panels is that Apple does use Samsung panels, and many of the issues that have been reported recently seem to be with the LG panels, although we do know that Apple wants to switch at some point and possibly move away from Samsung as their main supplier for OLED. But Samsung's been doing it a lot longer, and they've dealt with these issues for a while longer, so they tend to be minimized, I think, with the Samsung displays. And for new iPhone X owners, that's probably good news. But that's kind of the latest on how it went with the iPhone X launch. What about plans for future iPhones? We're starting to hear a few little stories coming to light about what Apple might be thinking of next. Of course, wireless charging technology or contactless charging technology is part of the iPhone X. I need to figure out which charger I want to get to actually test this out. I played around with it a little bit at the Apple Store with their demo phones with the iPhone 8, and the ones there I think were single coil designs, and you had to kind of align them pretty accurately, so I wasn't overall impressed. But Apple is working on the technology. I'm looking forward to seeing Apple's own charging solution, which should come out later this year or early next year. But Apple has also reportedly acquired a New Zealand-based wireless power company recently called Power by Proxy. Apple's Senior Vice President of Hardware Engineering, Dan Riccio, made some comments in an article recently for Stuff that confirmed Apple had acquired the company. The company makes something called the Proxy Module Platform. It's a wireless power and data transfer system designed for higher power applications. In fact, their technology could deliver up to 100 watts of power, which would be enough in theory for a MacBook Pro. So it's not 100% clear that this acquisition would just be for iDevices, but their system is based on the Qi wireless technology, which Apple is working with. And so we'll have to see where this pans out. But Apple certainly focused on wireless power for future products, iPhones, maybe even Macs at some point. On the iPhone front also, Ming-Chi Kuo doesn't believe that Apple will have the kinds of supply chain issues that they reportedly suffered from for the iPhone X launch, specifically related to the sensor bar technology. He thinks Apple's not really going to change the tech in 2018, so when it comes around for the 2018 update of the iPhone 11, is the iPhone going to go to 11 next year? He doesn't think Apple's going to run into that many issues. He's expecting other changes to happen, but that the Face ID technology, the sensor bar technology, the true depth camera system, and all of that should remain largely the same. He also doesn't think that Apple's going to add the tech to the FaceTime camera in the future. So that should help, again, keep the supply chain healthy for future models of iPhones. And it is expected that the technology may also make its way into iPads and other devices. So it'll become much more mature in 2018 and probably won't be a problem actually from the manufacturing side, at least according to Ming-Chi Kuo. And then finally, for the cellular modems, it's looking like Apple may drop Qualcomm as a supplier. The two companies have been at odds for a while now, ever since the FTC filed a complaint against Qualcomm, alleging that they forced Apple to use their chips at higher royalty rates. And Apple also filed their own lawsuit against Qualcomm. It is going to probably be hard for Apple to break free from Qualcomm, though. They may try. Starting with the iPhone 7, they have been using Intel chips along with the Qualcomm chips, and reportedly they may add a company called MediaTek as a second supplier for 2018 if they ultimately drop Qualcomm. But Qualcomm is a pretty big player, and they seem to kind of have a little bit better technology, at least when it comes to certain bands of the LTE spectrum. But Apple doing more with Intel, so we'll just have to wait and see. But expect that 2018 iPhones may finally be broken away from Qualcomm. And that's the latest that we know in these early days with what might be happening with new iPhones. The Financial Times reported this week that Apple has hired another television executive, this time a former BBC executive who has most recently been the chief creative officer at Channel 4, Jay Hunt. She's been responsible for shows like Black Mirror and Humans. While she was over at BBC One, she was also involved with shows like Luther and Sherlock, so quite a pedigree. And she reportedly will come on board at Apple in January, acting as their new creative director for European video. And this is actually, I think, the second big hire that we've seen Apple do on the international TV front. So I think that's a good sign that as they're building out their new original video content efforts, they're not just thinking locally here in the US, but also globally, especially in Europe. And hopefully they'll be able to launch new shows all at the same time. It's always been frustrating when we get stuff here in the US and our counterparts in other parts of the world don't get the same sorts of things. So hopefully it'll be a big international rollout and not just something that rolls out in one country first and then slowly out to other countries. There's also a report from Bloomberg about the kinds of content that Apple maybe wants to make, and somewhat related to the delayed release of Carpool Karaoke. If you remember, Carpool Karaoke was all set to go, and then suddenly, without warning, and we didn't really know why, it was delayed. Well, Bloomberg is saying that the problem was is that Tim Cook wanted edits and even some reshoots of some of the content because it was a little bit too blue, not quite family-friendly enough for Tim Cook and company. And the report also says that Apple, with their plans to release new shows and new original video content in 2019, they want those shows to also be pretty clean. They want creative and challenging shows, but they also want it to appeal to the broadest audience possible. And according to the report, the mandate is that anything Apple produces must be able to be shown in an Apple store out in public. So that means kids and families are going to be in there, and it has to pass that test. And I totally personally welcome that kind of content. You know, I love Game of Thrones. I love adult content. I love edgy, aggressive stuff. But at the moment, I think there's really a too big of a gap between good stories and good content and also shows that families can enjoy together. I think a lot of times it's trending toward that, you know, too violent, too much sex, too much everything on the cable side. And that's fine. I'm not a prude. I'm not against that sort of thing. But I also like stuff that I can sit down and watch with my family. And it seems like there's not a lot of that content. So if Apple can jump in and sort of fill that void, I think that's a really cool niche for them to go after. Now, it remains to be seen if that tact is going to be successful. And it reportedly is turning off some of the producers and people in Hollywood. They're coming to Apple. Apple's telling them this, and they're going away. They're labeling Apple as too conservative. But, you know, for me, given recent events of things that we're hearing about in Hollywood, maybe this is really actually a good thing. And the report also notes that Apple really, with their original content efforts, is not looking to go head-to-head against Walt Disney, Netflix, and HBO. So you might look at this decision and go, well, they're going to have a really hard time competing. And the point is they're not trying to compete. They're wanting to basically complement those video services and offerings from those other sources. So we'll be able to get a little bit of everything. If you want your edgy adult stuff, go to HBO and Showtime, maybe even Netflix and Amazon. If you want more wholesome, family-friendly kind of stuff that you can sit down together and enjoy, that's actually really good. I think this is the key. They're looking for really good, compelling stories that are doing creative things, that are smart, but just have a little bit less, you know, adult slant to them. And I think ultimately that's going to be a great thing. I know I'm going to appreciate having the choice and the options. And it does make sense that they're going to try to complement rather than compete. We'll have to wait to see how successful they end up being with that. But I'd love your thoughts and opinions on this. What do you think? Is this the right direction for Apple to take? I think if they can do that with a show like Amazing Stories, that's some great content that I'm really excited about. I think it's going to be a win-win all the way around. But again, I'd love your opinion. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. This week we had a little privacy concern or something come up in the privacy realm related to the camera on your iOS device. A developer, Felix Krauss, actually posted a proof of concept application that he put out to highlight basically what happens when you grant an app access to your camera in iOS. And specifically what he noted was that the camera could, once you've given it permission, because it will pop up and ask, you end up giving it access to both the front and back camera. It will allow the application to record video anytime the app is open and in the foreground. It can take pictures and videos without really alerting you to the fact that it's taking those, again, because you've already pre-granted it permission. It can also upload those pictures and videos that it takes immediately to a server and even run real-time face recognition to detect things like facial features or expressions. And he pointed out there's no other kind of indicators like a light or a visual indicator that the camera is live and in use. And he's just saying, you know, this seems a little bit like a privacy security concern. And he has a few suggestions on how to deal with this. He says, you know, there should be more granularity in what kinds of permissions we give an app to when it asks for access to the camera. One thing would be, hey, just allow access for this one session, this one use of the application. And then when I quit it, revoke that permission. As opposed to right now, you either have to say yes or no. And then once it's turned on, it always has access to that camera until you go into the settings and implicitly turn it off. He's also saying that there should be some sort of icon in the status bar to let us know when the camera is active when you're using an app. And maybe even there should be an LED that lights up on the front of your iPhone like it would on your Mac when the camera is active. And I would also take it one step further and say, why isn't there an icon in the privacy settings? So you can go into the privacy settings for the camera and see which apps have access or which apps you've given access to and revoke that. But maybe a little icon like we have for location services, which show which apps last accessed the camera and when, how recently, you know, did this app access the camera in the last 24 hours? I don't remember, you know, going in and using the app or doing anything with the app where I would think it used the camera. That would be a nice little alert. Like I said, you can check which apps have camera access currently in iOS by going into settings, privacy, and then camera. But, you know, is this a real big problem? I think if you're using trusted apps from trusted developers, it's probably not an issue, but I kind of get the points at the same time. I don't think it's kind of a panic situation. I think Apple's done a pretty good job of trying to let us know when a camera or when an application has asked for access to the camera. The point Felix is trying to make here is that, well, you know, once you've given that access, do you remember what's going on with it? You could have a potentially bad actor go in, a bad developer go in and take advantage of this. And we've seen it in the past with access to things like contacts and other stuff. As a matter of fact, the same developer has done a couple other proof of concepts you may have heard about recently, one called Detect Location and another one called Steal Password. The Detect Location one would go in, and if you granted access to your photo library, it would read all of the location data from all your photos and essentially create a map of the dates and times and locations where you took those photos and send that to a server. So it kind of gives you a way to track a user, see where they're going and where they've been taking photographs. And again, a little bit concerning, and in a malicious app taking advantage of that could be a thing to be concerned about. The other one was called Steal Password, and it showed how easy it was to pop up a dialogue that really looked like a system dialogue asking for you to log into iCloud and give your iCloud password. And it was actually one that could be generated by the app itself. And if you entered that information, it could potentially get sent to a developer or a malicious website, again, through the app. So the caveat to all these things is it does require you to download an app from the App Store. So it would have to get through Apple's app review, and hopefully they would catch any kind of malicious app before that you know, it even got that far. But let's say it got through that process, you downloaded the app, and it started doing some of these malicious things, you still have to give it permission to access the camera. You still have to be aware of what it's popping up and those sorts of things, what developer it came from. So I think the concern is that oftentimes we don't know where our apps are coming from. We just get a random app off the App Store to do something, and it could be coming from, you know, any place in the world, from any kind of developer. Yes, they've had to be vetted through the App Store. Yes, it had to go through an App Store review. But, you know, how much do we really know? So I think some of the suggestions being made are good. I think the fact that he's starting the conversation, creating these proof of concepts so that we can think about these things, so that it draws Apple's attention to it, I think that's, you know, these things are great. But it really does point out that even with all of the protections Apple has put in place, we always need to be aware and diligent about what kinds of access we are allowing to our data. You know, if an app pops up and says, can I have access to your contacts or your location or your photos? Think about why that app would need that permission. And if it doesn't seem relevant, then always, I would say always, say no. Until you know the reason why. We should always be asking ourselves, why does it need this access? What feature in this app is giving me that benefit of allowing this kind of permission and access? Then that's the kind of question we should always ask ourselves and not allow it. You know, the default option should be no, not yes. And I think too often for many of us, the default option is yes. So that would be kind of my recommendation. But absolutely, maybe Apple should be doing a little bit more to make us a little bit more aware of when things like the camera are being accessed or location is being accessed. And that's always a good thing. Another thing somewhat related to this that came up this week, the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union, raised some privacy concern over the developer access to the facial expressions of the sensor bar or the true depth camera on the iPhone X. Now, to be clear, the 3D facial recognition models, the stuff that is taken and stored for Face ID, all of that stuff is secure. It's stored only on your device, and it's not made available to third-party apps. But third-party apps are allowed to ask permission to access a rough map of your face, and also to be able to detect up to 50 different kinds of facial expressions. So this would be, say, for example, maybe a photo app that wants to use the fact that are people in this photo smiling or not as an indicator to maybe auto-select the best photo in a series of photos for you. Or maybe a video game where they want you to be able to control the facial expressions of a character or something like that. Or maybe map your face your facial expressions onto a character. That kind of data is available and can be accessed by developers. The data can also be sent potentially to developers' servers. Now, again, Apple has very specific rules around how developers are allowed to access and use this data. First of all, they do need to get your permission to access the data, so you'll get a dialogue and you'll know which apps are trying to get access to 3D facial recognition data. They also agree that they're not going to sell that data to third parties, and they also must use the data for specific functionality in the app. They need to tell you what that is. The concern is, of course, like us all, developers don't necessarily fully read terms of service, and they might try to use that data for marketing or advertising purposes without knowing that they're not allowed to do that simply because they haven't read the terms of service. Now, that isn't an excuse for them to do those sorts of things, but the concern from the ACLU is that, hey, apps might start trying to do some of this stuff. And just like having camera access, as we noted earlier, this could also allow for malicious apps and people to try and do some of this stuff without us really knowing. So it's not really new stuff going on here, but just again, more things that bring up privacy concerns that we probably should all be aware of. And ultimately, I think at the end of the day, it's a matter of trust, right? Do we trust Apple to do the job that they say they do with vetting apps and making sure bad stuff doesn't get through? Do we trust the developers making the apps not to use these technologies in bad or malicious ways? Do we trust ourselves to, you know, protect our own data and our information and make the right choices when we're asked about some of this privacy stuff and make sure that we turn stuff off and say no. So again, I'm bringing all this stuff up not to create a sense of panic or concern, as, you know, has been happening in the media lately, and you might have run across this stuff, but more to say to you, hey, look, this stuff's going on. These are things we need to think about, we need to have conversations about, and certainly hold Apple accountable to make sure that they're doing the best possible things they can do to help protect our data and our privacy. And I think overall they're doing a really pretty good job. Could they do better? I think there's always ways they could do better, and these kinds of conversations will lead to those new features and technologies. So ultimately, I think it's really a good thing. If you have an Apple Watch Series 3, you might want to take a look closely at the side of it and see if you have a little bit of an issue, specifically if you have a GPS model. 9to5 Mac is reporting that Apple has recently informed its retail and authorized third-party repair staff of a possible issue affecting some Apple Watch Series 3 GPS models. The issue seems to be that the displays are showing a series of stripe markings along the edge of the watch display. Apparently, it's easiest to see this problem when the display is turned off, and the information given to 9to5 Mac seems to indicate that, again, only the GPS model seems to be affected. If you have one of the cellular data models, at least for now, it doesn't seem like it has the problem. Staff are being told to have the customer either rub their finger along the edge of the display to kind of smear it or fog it up with their breath to best see this issue. So if you have the problem, you might, or if you think you may have the problem, you might want to try one of those techniques. And if you see a series of lines in there, very distinct stripe marks, and they're evenly spaced, then you probably want to contact Apple or get your Apple Watch to a third-party Apple-authorized repair center. They don't specifically say what the cause is, other than suspecting that it's some sort of manufacturing defect. And again, it does seem to be fairly isolated at this point, so I don't think it's widespread. 9to5 Mac noted that they asked several of their readers, and nobody in their audience has reported noting the issues. If you do have an affected device, it does appear what Apple is doing is they're sending it in for a complete replacement. They're not doing a swap in the store, but they'll take your Apple Watch in, send it into their main center, and you will get a replacement shipped out to you. So hopefully none of you in the MacCast community have this problem, but if you do, it does sound like Apple is going to take care of it. And then finally, in the news for this week, Apple announced its fourth quarter results, and they were amazing. Usually they're always amazing, but this time around, because we had multiple iPhone models coming out, there was some speculation that maybe Apple might not hit some of their targets with folks waiting on the iPhone X. But wow, Apple did an amazing quarter. Revenue of $52.6 billion, actually up 12% from 2016. Apple sold 10.3 million iPads, 46.7 million iPhones, and 5.4 million Macs during the quarter. All of those numbers up from the same quarter a year ago. Initial sales from the iPhone 8 and 8 Plus were included in the total quarterly numbers, of course, for iPhones. We don't get an exact breakout, but the fact that iPhone did so well in this quarter does seem to indicate that there's pretty good demand for the iPhone 8 and iPhone 8 Plus in the quarter, and Apple has made statements to say that both of those phones sold better than expected. Revenue from Apple's services was at $8.5 billion. That was up from $6.33 billion in the same quarter last year. So services is now huge for Apple. It's become their second largest source of revenue behind the iPhone. And as a matter of fact, if you add up the combined revenue from iPads, Apple Watch, Apple TV, AirPods, Beats, all of Apple's accessories, combine all of those things, services makes up more revenue than all of that stuff together. So we can fully expect that Apple is going to continue to drive services very aggressively. And I think that's why we're seeing so much money and energy being put behind their original video content efforts. I think that's kind of the next step for them. They've done a great job beefing up iCloud services and those sorts of things. I love iCloud Photo Library and also iCloud backups, and the fact that families can now share backup storage data. Apple's doing a great job of pushing that stuff forward, and I fully expect it to become a bigger and bigger portion of their revenue stream. But it's really interesting to see, you know, Apple started out as a computer company selling Macs, and now it's really iPhones and services that are driving the company moving forward. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. I want to follow up a little bit on the conversation we've been having over the last few episodes about the Apple TV 4K and HDR. We had Ara Derderian from the HDTV podcast on, and we were talking about the fact that the Apple TV basically forces all of the, in its current form at least, forces all of the content coming in, regardless of whether it's HDR or 4K, into the best quality format or the best settings for the TV that you have it hooked up to. So if you have a 4K TV with HDR 10, then it's going to put it in at a 60 hertz refresh rate. It is going to put it into that format automatically. Now, you could go in and actually change those settings manually, but it doesn't dynamically update based on the content that is coming in. And that was a little bit of an issue for some people. Well, guess what? It turns out that is about to change, and change very quickly. You're no longer going to have to do it manually if you don't want to. You still will be able to, but Apple is pushing out a fix. We have heard that tvOS 11.2 beta now has settings for match dynamic range and match frame rate, meaning that if you choose to turn this new feature on, it will match the dynamic range, HDR or SDR, and match the frame rate of the content coming into the Apple TV box, and that's what it will output to your television. So it won't tweak any of the settings if you don't want to. Of course, you can still go in and do the manual thing, or you could turn these features off if you want to have it work the way it has been working. So it's really nice to see Apple, I'm assuming, listening to some of the feedback that they got and adding that feature. I don't know why it wasn't there day one, other than maybe Apple didn't think it was going to be as big a deal. But always good to see Apple maybe listening to the community. And it does appear this will work automatically also for apps who display their content using Apple's AV kit. And Apple has also, along with this, released an API to developers to allow the feature to work for apps that don't use AVKit. So some apps may have to actually be updated in order to support this feature, but a lot of them right out of the box, if they're using AVKit, are going to be able to support this. So I know there were a few of you out there who didn't want to buy an Apple TV 4K because it didn't have this feature. Looks like it will be coming in 11.2 beta. When that will come out, we don't know, but I would imagine in the next weeks to month or so, we should see that, probably within weeks. So the big thing this week, of course, is the release of the iPhone X. I did purchase one. I bought a 256 gigabyte space gray model. I received mine on Friday, November 3rd, about mid-afternoon, and proceeded to set it up. I did this time around choose to use Apple's new Quick Setup, which is part of iOS 11, and I have to tell you, it was pretty amazing. Basically, this allows you to take your old phone, hold it next to the new phone, and it will transfer over all of your settings, all of your data, everything instantly without having to connect to a computer. You just have to be hooked up to Wi-Fi. It did work pretty well for me. I did run into a couple moments where I kind of backed up or had to backtrack, and that caused a little bit of a problem. I can't remember specifically what happened. I think some of the settings didn't come over, and I bounced around a little bit. But overall, it worked very well for me, and many of you have reported to me that it went completely smoothly for you. So I would say it's probably the easiest way to set up an iPhone. In the past, my methodology had always been to connect my old device into iTunes and do a full backup using encryption, because that retains all of the health data, health and fitness data, along with all of your network settings and passwords and those sorts of things. I am hearing mixed reports that that methodology does not work if you're upgrading to an iPhone X. I have a listener in the community who is a pretty good trusted source who's been reporting that he tried doing this with his upgrade and wasn't able to upgrade from an iPhone 7 to an iPhone 10 using that method. I'm not really sure why that wouldn't work, but it seems like the devices are different enough in the underlying technology that it won't allow you to restore from that backup. So if anybody else has had that experience, let me know. I'm going to be looking into it a little bit further. It just kind of came up as I was getting ready to record this podcast. So I want to throw that out there in case some of you are also having that problem. As far as a like big review on features, I'm not going to do that here. I need a lot more time to form hard opinions about the iPhone X, but I am going to share my first impressions with you. I've only had it for about a day, a little over 24 hours. So, you know, it's hard to say a lot of things about it. Want to comment on a few features, kind of key features, and then also throw it out to get your opinions if you've done an upgrade to an iPhone X. Let's start off with the screen. I would say the screen is really good, right? It's Apple's first use of an OLED display in an iPhone. Is it revolutionary? I don't know. It looks great. It looks really good. I agree with the fact that everything looks like it's kind of sitting right on the surface as opposed to you looking through glass. But when I put the two side by side, I would say it's not like the leap from a non-retina display to a retina display. I mean, that was a huge leap forward in display technology. I would say overall, it has much better contrast. It has rich, deep blacks, which are indicative of an OLED display. It is crisp. It is sharp. It is beautiful. Definitely evolutionary. I don't know if I'd go so far as to say revolutionary. If I had to go back to a retina display, say on an iPhone 8 or an iPhone 8 Plus or even my iPhone 7, which I've been comparing it against, for me, my eyes don't notice enough of a difference where I would go, oh, you know, that iPhone 7 display, I can't go back to it. And retina really was kind of like that, right? When you move to a retina display from a non-retina display, it was hard to go back and look at that non-retina display. I don't think that's the case here. Very good technology. But I think because Apple's LCD technology is really top-notch, it really shows off how good Apple's LCD technology was. It's like the OLED display on the iPhone shows what a great job Apple did with LCD, because really the difference between the two is not astronomical. I would say, you know, it's 10% better, 15% better, maybe. And if you have an older device, you have an iPhone 7, an iPhone 8, and you're like, oh, maybe I should get the 10 because of the display. I don't think the display alone is enough to do the upgrade. I guess that's probably the ultimate point. Of course, the big thing many of you are probably wondering about is Face ID. How good is it? Is it really as good as Touch ID? Is it better than Touch ID? Again, I think it's a little bit too early to tell, but here's my initial thoughts. The setup, definitely easier and better. I mean, it's super quick. You do two quick scans and you're good to go. Is it better than Touch ID? That's a little bit trickier to answer. I think it has some advantages when it works. The speed can be faster or slower so far for me, depending upon the situation and how I'm accessing it. The attention part of it, the fact that it needs to get your attention, is pretty deliberate. As I kind of thought, you do need to be really looking at the device. Of course, you can turn that off in accessibility, but if you do that, you're going to be losing some of the security of it. So I would say most people are going to want to get, you know, leave it turned on. But I can't just glance down at it when it's laying on my desk. I actually need to pick up the phone and kind of put it at least at a lower angle in front of my face. The cameras need to be pointed at your face for it to really work. And that's probably the next issue that I have with it, is there is kind of an optimal distance for Face ID. Apple says the range is between 25 centimeters and 50 centimeters, about 10 to 20 inches away from your face. And something I noticed almost immediately for me, because I'm 46, a little bit older, I'm getting older, my eyes are starting to go bad. I'm not quite ready for reading glasses yet, but when I am looking at my phone, I'm nearsighted, so I have to take my regular glasses off. And I do have to hold the phone a little bit closer to my face. I have old eyes, and the phone naturally ends up being about 8 inches from my face. And so, therefore, the reliability of Face ID for me at that distance falls off a little bit. It seems to work about 50% of the time at that distance. Now, when it doesn't work, I just have to pull the phone back a little bit more, and it immediately works. But that's a problem, and it also means that it's maybe easier to get locked out of the device. And that's another thing that I think is different than Touch ID. If you have a family member who's just gone and picked up your phone, chances are it's going to lock out and move to the point where next time you pick it up, and this has already happened to me a few times, I've had to ask family members, hey, were you looking at my phone? Oh yeah, I picked it up, I was checking it out, and it turns out it locked me out and I had to enter my passcode to get Face ID reactivated again. That typically doesn't happen with Touch ID because they actually need to be putting their finger on the fingerprint sensor and not just simply picking up your phone and looking at it. So that's a little bit of a nuisance. Again, not a huge deal breaker, but definitely something different when you're moving from Touch ID to Face ID. And I have to say, if you want to get the optimal speed, really the best way to use it is not to wait for the little lock icon. For those of you who haven't seen a demo of how Face ID works, there's now a new little lock icon at the top of your display. And when you wake up the display, either by, because there's no home button, pressing the side button, or simply tapping the display or using the lift to wake feature, when the screen comes on, there's a white lock at the top. And once the Face ID detector sees that it has your attention and you're looking at the display and recognizes your face, then that little lock icon unlocks, and then you can swipe up to open the phone. What many have found, and I totally agree with this, is it's best not to wait for any of that. Simply pick up the phone and start swiping up, and Face ID most of the time will immediately recognize your face as all that stuff's happening, and it's absolutely the fastest way to wake up your phone. Now, if it doesn't work, it's going to drop you to enter in the passcode, and that's a little bit annoying. I wish it was a little bit easier to have it do a second scan or check again. I found that even just moving the phone around or doing something else doesn't really work. I have to kind of put the phone back to sleep and wake it back up, or simply enter in the passcode, and that does seem to slow things down a little bit. I'm asking myself, you know, between the number of times where I have a wet finger or some moisture on my finger where the Touch ID sensor didn't work for me versus how often I'm getting Face ID not working, is it really different? At least initially, again, this is early days, it feels to me like Face ID fails a little bit more often, but I think it's a learning curve thing. I think once I learn the pattern for using Face ID, much in the same way I had to do for Touch ID, I think it's going to be about a wash. The two will end up ultimately being the same. So, you know, the jury's out for me on Face ID. I'm feeling little pangs of loss for Touch ID at this point, I have to say. But as you know, I loved Touch ID. I thought it was almost a perfect technology. Is Face ID there? Could it potentially be for me? Maybe. And that's what I'm going to say for right now. So great, maybe not perfect. The other thing is the loss of the home button. You know, with no home button, what about new gestures? Everything is now a new gesture. Swipe up from the bottom to unlock the phone. Swipe up and hold to access the app switcher. Pulling down from the top horns or ears next to the notch to access Notification Center and Control Center. All of these things are different. All of these things are new gestures. And they're going to take some time to learn. But I have to say, even after about 24 hours, I've already gotten used to most of them, and they're becoming much more natural. A few times, I will admit, I've tried to press the home button that isn't there, but I think that's a little bit of muscle memory, and I think I'm going to get over that quickly. I'm finding I'm getting that over that more quickly than I would have thought. And I have some tips a little bit later for those of you who are using an iPhone X or who now have an iPhone X on some of these things, some things I've discovered that I think make using some of the new gestures even a little bit easier. And I apologize because it looks like my notes got a little bit out of order here. I did have another thing to talk to you about related to Face ID, and that's a couple of YouTube videos surfacing that shows brothers, not twins, seeming to be able to fool Face ID. Apple, in the Worldwide Developer Conference keynote, did note that if you have an identical twin, that identical twins can probably fool Face ID. They didn't specifically mention siblings, and so these videos surfaced where a couple of brothers, in one instance it was a brother and an older brother and a younger brother, where the younger brother was about 14. He was able to unlock his brother's phone, and then also a couple of other brothers who were adults but were 3 years apart and looked very similar to each other, even having the same kind of glasses or almost the same shaped glasses. Apple does note in a support article that Face ID is not reliable for kids under 13, so I don't know if that's a factor in the brothers where one was 14 years old. But the question became, and a lot of people are questioning, what's going on here? Is this just a case of, hey, these guys are falling in the one in a million? You know, if Apple sells 10 million iPhones, then presumably there would be 10 pairs of people out there that could fool Face ID, right? Apple's own support article actually makes some comments on this. They say, quote, the statistical probability for Face ID, and I'm paraphrasing here, is different for twins and siblings that look like you and among children under the age of 13, because their distinct facial features have not fully developed. If you're concerned about this, we recommend using a passcode to authenticate. And that's an important thing, actually, is Apple, if you read that, you recognize, and Apple again said this at the Worldwide Developer Conference, they're saying if you're concerned about Face ID, really a passcode, that's the ultimate lock. And it's always been that way, even with Touch ID, right? Because if Touch ID fails, what does it fall back to? It falls back to a passcode. So in Apple's mind, the passcode is the most secure way to secure your phone. Now, we could argue about that depending upon the passcode that you picked, but assuming you've picked a long, complex, and good alphanumeric or long numeric passcode, that should be your best protection. And I'm bringing this up because Apple actually also wrote a white paper about the way Face ID technology works that kind of explains what's going on here and why siblings may be able to unlock each other's phones. There's something you're not noticing probably or seeing in these videos. Now, I think the one from the two brothers who were older, I think they released a follow-up video that noted this, but of course, many blogs didn't report on that. They only reported on the sensational fact that everybody's looking for a way to see Face ID fail right now. And a lot of the stories that we're seeing are trying to find a way to fool Face ID. And here we have two examples, and everybody's going to immediately point it out. See, Apple's Face ID, total failure. Siblings can fool it. Well, what's going on here is actually a little bit more, as it always is, a little bit more complex. So what happens if Face ID fails with a face match? So you hold it up to your face, it doesn't detect it for some reason. What it's going to do is it's going to set a score for that match, a threshold. And if it's a high enough threshold where it thinks, oh, this might be you, but it's not high enough for me to allow you to unlock the phone, but I think it's pretty close, and then it goes to the passcode lock. When you enter the passcode, it will go, oh, okay, well, it's obviously you because you know the passcode, and I'm looking at you right now, and my scan says it's a high probability that it's probably you. So those two things together, it says to itself, oh, okay, well, let me learn from that. Maybe your face has changed a little bit. Maybe you started to grow a beard. Maybe you put on some makeup. Let me learn that. And so the next time you use Face ID, I'm going to add that to my data, and I will assume that if I get within that close threshold and it matches similarly, that, yeah, that's you, I will go ahead and unlock your phone. In these brother tests, what was happening is the brothers gave each other the passcode. So one brother, the one it was set up for, it would unlock for fine. He would hand the phone to his other brother. It would fail. The brother would enter the passcode, And guess what? Yeah, the brothers look similar enough that it was probably within that high probability threshold. So it added now that second brother's data to the first brother's data. And of course, then the next unlock works for the second brother. That's what's going on. Now, Apple's white paper also explains that this data is temporary data, and it's discarded after a finite number of unlocks, or if you stop matching against it. So it's using it temporarily. Now, why would it do that? Well, it's part of the system used to keep up, again, with dynamic changes to your face, either facial hair or probably more appropriately makeup. So imagine someone who did their initial scan, not wearing makeup, and then they go out for an evening on the town and they've totally changed their appearance with makeup. That first time it fails, it's going to fail. They're going to enter the passcode, and now it's going to temporarily add a version of that facial scan with the makeup intact. And it's going to use that for a limited amount of time. And then when the makeup is removed again, it will remove that data and go back to the way it was. So all of this is to help minimize false acceptance of Face ID data. So as usually happens, right, everything is not immediately as it seems. And we have to step back and remember everybody's looking for Face ID to have a problem. And when you're looking that hard, you're going to find ways and you're going to make up ways to make your what you want to be reality, potentially a reality. You know, is there going to be some flaw or failure in Face ID that's legitimate? Maybe. But this one isn't it. So I wanted to bring this up because it was been making the rounds. And I wanted you to have, again, all of the information related to why this is happening and what's going on. And I have to give credit to Renee Ritchie over at iMore for specifically pointing out the stuff that's in the white paper. He wrote a great article about this, and that's where I found a lot of this information. So, you know, follow Renee Ritchie. He's a smart guy. Check out iMore.com. They do a lot of great writing on this stuff. But there you have it. That's why siblings can potentially fool Face ID. All right, back to kind of my impressions and reviews. Probably the thing I'm most excited about with the new iPhone X, and again, this is going to take a lot longer for me to evaluate, is the new cameras. I am super excited about finally having the dual camera system in a phone that is just a little bit larger than my iPhone 7. That is totally awesome. As you know, I've never been a fan of the plus size phones, but I have been envious of those cameras. So the question becomes, how does this compare to the iPhone 8 Plus camera spec-wise? Starting with the EyeSight camera, the rear-facing camera, they both use a 12-megapixel sensor for the lenses. They have a wide lens and a telephoto lens. The wide lens on both is an f1.8 with optical image stabilization, and that's the same for the iPhone X and the iPhone 8 Plus. The telephoto lens, though, is slightly faster on the iPhone X, f2.4 versus f2.8, and the telephoto lens on the iPhone X has optical image stabilization as well, where it doesn't on the iPhone 8. When you turn around and get to the front-facing camera, the FaceTime camera, they both use a 7-megapixel sensor, but the iPhone 10, of course, has the whole true-depth camera system, so the IR and the dot projector and all of those sorts of things. And that's the kind of stuff that makes features like portrait lighting effects work for both cameras on the iPhone 10, whereas on the iPhone 8 Plus, you can only use it with the EyeSight camera. I have to say the portrait lighting effects work pretty good. I would say still that they are beta, especially for the stage lighting effects. Apple, you know, has said they are in beta mode, similar to the way they launched the portrait effect on the iPhone 7 and 7 Plus. The reason I say it's beta with the lighting effects is there are some little nuances. You kind of have to get the right shot to have the effect applied really accurately. I took a couple shots where especially with the stage lighting, it was cropping out. The masking wasn't quite perfect, and you actually lost portions of a person's face, for example, which wasn't great. So depending upon how that shot is, there's a little bit of work, I think, that needs to be done. But again, Apple has said it's beta, and I'm sure it will get better over time. You can use, as I said, the portrait lighting effects both on the EyeSight and the FaceTime camera, which is really nice. And I really just do like the portrait mode, which looks great. Again, depending upon the shot, it can struggle a little bit, but I think Apple does a really pretty good job with the whole portrait effect, and I'm looking forward to using that feature even more. I also like the fact that you can add or change the portrait effects after taking the photo, so they can be reapplied or changed. You can change the lighting effect when you go in to actually do your editing. So if you did one mode and you like another mode better, you can always switch it back and forth. Let's talk a little bit about what is likely the funnest feature of the iPhone X. And I'm actually surprised at how much I really like this. And it's the Animoji. Animoji with the TrueDepth camera system is freaking awesome. It is so much fun. It is hilarious. It is amazing how well it works. If your iPhone is kind of getting bogged down with background tasks or things like that, it can get a little flaky. But overall, it is really impressive. And we already have Animoji karaoke, already a meme within hours related to Animoji, thanks to Harry McCracken, who pioneered it. You have probably, if you've been on social media at all since Friday, Facebook, Twitter, wherever, I'm sure you've seen one of these things. Basically, you fire up the Animoji, you play a song, and you lip sync so that the Animoji are lip syncing to a track, and you have to play the song loud enough through the speakers so that it gets picked up by the microphone. And also the trick is, because in the Messages app where you do Animoji, you can only record about a 10-second Animoji to send as a message. But if you use the built-in screen recording feature in iOS 11, you basically just record the motion, which is tracked immediately when you start using the app, and then take that and bring it into another application for editing. So then create a video of it, and then you can post that wherever you want. So kind of a cool, fun feature. It remains to be seen how long it's going to stick around. You know, it's a great demo app. It is something, believe it or not, that is going to sell iPhones, you know, much in the same way that Photo Booth on the Mac sold Macs. I think Animoji is going to sell a lot of iPhone X's. Now, this is despite the fact that many blogs and websites are reporting that Animoji makes the $1,000 price tag, $1,000 plus price tag of an iPhone X totally worth it. That's why you should buy it. Despite what your favorite blogger or YouTuber is saying, I'm not going to go that far and tell you that. Is it super fun? Yeah. Is it awesome? Yeah. Is it something you should pay $1,000 to get that feature? Absolutely not. Don't buy the iPhone for that. There's a lot of other good reasons for upgrading to or buying an iPhone X. Animoji may be a factor of that, a small factor of that, but it shouldn't be the only thing. A few other odds and ends related to my first experience. I did have, or am having, a little bit of trouble with Siri on the iPhone X. I don't know if this is related to the speakers, which, by the way, sound amazing. The stereo speakers, Apple, I believe, says are about 25% louder. They seem even louder than that to me. I put the volume at about 25-33%, and it is pretty darn loud. It actually starts to hurt my ears if I turn the volume all the way up and I'm not in a noisy environment. So the speakers sound great, but that is giving me maybe a little bit of trouble, or maybe the microphones are a little bit too sensitive, because when I use Siri, it seems to be struggling to understand or hear me when there is background noise. What I'm experiencing specifically in the car when I'm listening to a podcast or I have music playing is that if the volume is up over about 25%, Siri cannot recognize any commands, including the, activate Siri command that we all know when you're going hands-free. And that's not working for me, and that's been very frustrating. I've also been noticing that it seems like Siri is picking up audio or stuff from the audio that I've been playing. So even though it cuts out, there's some sort of delay and she's picking up extra words from the podcast and that's confusing her translations. And I don't remember that happening with my iPhone 7. I wasn't having that problem. And I kind of tweeted about this a little bit and a few of you have confirmed that you're having similar problems. So hopefully this is a software issue and not a hardware issue, just a maybe minor tweaking of the noise cancellation or adjustments to the microphone that needs to happen. I'll be filing a bug report with Apple because it does feel like it's a bug. I don't think I had it on my prior model, but that has been a little bit frustrating with the iPhone X. But otherwise, I'm really enjoying it overall. I think it's a great upgrade. I'm going to enjoy a lot of the new features. So ultimately, I think the question you're asking me a lot is, should I buy it? Do I need to upgrade? Is it worth upgrading? I'm getting a lot of those questions from you via email. And my answer is going to be kind of the same as it was when we talked about this before the pre-orders. I think it really depends on what kind of an iPhone user you are and where you're at in your iPhone upgrade cycle. I think if you have an iPhone 7 or maybe even a 6S and you're totally happy with it, I'm not entirely convinced that there's enough in here to say, yeah, it's a must-have upgrade. There's a lot of nice new features in here. The new camera system, the size of the phone, the edge-to-edge display. Oh, I guess we didn't talk about the notch. How can I forget about the notch? Here's the thing on the notch, and this is really straightforward and quick. It's a non-issue for me. Almost immediately, it just faded to the background. I really don't notice in day-to-day usage that it's even there. If I specifically think about it and look for it, yeah, it can get in the way. There are some specific apps that I have that haven't been updated, including Apple's own TV app, the video app. If you turn it into portrait mode, there's some data that falls under the notch, and that's a little bit annoying, but that stuff's going to sort itself out. Outside of those little things, I don't notice it at all. Not one iota, not one bit. It has not been a problem. And overall, I think I'm okay with the design. I kind of like how unique it is. I like how the notification bar icons kind of tuck into the ears, into the horn area, as Renee Ritchie puts it a little bit. I think it works well, and I think once apps have adapted to it, it's really a non-issue. So all of the notch hate that's out there, that's fine if you don't like it. I get it. If you think it's an ugly design, don't buy the phone. You have a great iPhone 8 and 8 Plus model to choose from. But if you know you're on the fence about it and you're not really sure, I have to tell you, it just fades into the background. It's similar to, you know, the black bars on a movie, or if you're watching an old TV show on Netflix and you get the sidebars. Once you're engrossed in the content, once that's the focus of what you're looking at, which it should be when you're interacting with your phone, then the notches totally fade into the background. So that's my opinion on the notch. Okay, back to should you buy it? Well, yeah, it depends on where you're at in the upgrade cycle, what kind of user you are. Excuse me. If you need to have the latest and greatest thing and you can afford it, yeah, absolutely go for it. You're going to love the phone. The design is great. The styling is great. All of the new features are awesome so far. I've had very few issues, again, with the caveat that I've only had about 24 hours with it, so stuff still could crop up. So I don't know if I'd take it to the bank yet, but it seems great so far. If you're in the upgrade cycle and your phone's a few years old and you want some of the new features, especially like me, I really wanted the new cameras on a phone in the size range of an iPhone 7. Yeah, it's worth the upgrade if that's the kind of thing that you're going for. If you don't mind paying, you're on the upgrade plan and you don't mind paying an extra $10 to $20 a month in payments, then I think, yeah, maybe this would be a worthwhile upgrade, even if you're rocking an iPhone 7 at this point. The iPhone 8 and 8 Plus, these are great options, right? And you pay a little bit less. And if you really are the type of person where you're like, I love Touch ID and I don't think Face ID is going to be the thing for me, then go for that upgrade if you're ready to upgrade. I think the good news here is that Apple now has a lot of great choices with a lot of great technology in the iPhone lineup. And they have a whole range of price points. And I think a lot of this ultimately comes down to features and price. What features do you want, and what are you willing to pay for those features? All of the features are great features. Face ID is a nice new technology. It's the latest and greatest stuff. Does it beat Touch ID? For me, I would put them at this point at least on level playing field, and I think Touch ID, 24 hours into this, has a little bit of an edge in my opinion. Will I flop on that? I could after a couple weeks, after I kind of learn these new techniques. But again, I don't think either choice is bad, and that's what's really awesome. I think all of the choices are good, and you just need to make the choice that's right for you. And I think in a lot of cases, it's going to come down to price and where you're at in your upgrade cycle. I think if you have an iPhone 7, it's definitely not a must-have upgrade. Maybe you wait for the iPhone 11 and a bunch of other great new features that are going to mean more to you and maybe bring more value. And you know, that's kind of my opinion on it. But again, I'd love your thoughts and opinions. I know many of you purchased iPhone 8s and 8 Pluses. Many of you upgraded to iPhone 10s. All of you, share your thoughts and opinions with me. What do you think about all this stuff? Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. If you have upgraded to a new iPhone 10, here's a couple little tips and tricks that I've discovered in my 24 plus hours of using it. Something you can do when you're doing app switching: if you're in an app, you now have the new little home indicator, the kind of gesture bar line that sits on the bottom. You can actually swipe on that bar left to right to switch between your apps rather than going into the app switcher. If you do want to access the app switcher, this confused me at first because I wasn't really sure what to do. No home button, right? No double tap. You swipe up from the bottom, and then rather than keep going, you simply hold or pause for a second, and that will pop up the app switcher. To me, that seemed a little bit slow, kind of like a slow gesture. So what I've discovered is you can actually kind of do it all in one motion if you do a swiping arc, and that seems to work faster for me, and I haven't seen anybody note this. So basically, swipe up from the bottom to the left or right edge. I find it easier to do with my thumb because I'm right-handed over to the left edge. So you just swipe up in one single motion and kind of arc to the left, and that will go right into the app switcher, and then you can let go and then simply switch through your apps, and that works for me pretty well. Somebody asked me about an all-black wallpaper, if I knew of one, because again, with the OLED display, displaying blacks on the screen doesn't use up as much energy. So you might be able to eke out a little bit more battery life if you're using a darker background, or if you're using apps that have darker backgrounds, or even if your home screen uses a dark wallpaper. Well, Apple actually has included a bunch of new wallpapers in the settings. So just go into your background settings and look for the new wallpapers. There is an all black one, and they also just have some darker ones that might help extend your battery life. So nice little tip there. Of course, you can go out and find a third party one as well, but you may not need to. What about hard rebooting? This came up for me because I wanted to hard reboot the phone, and I realized, well, the old gesture, sleep wake button, or the side button, and the home button. No home button. How do I do it? Apple has remapped the, you know, my first thought was press the side button and one of the volume buttons together and keep them held down. But that actually is for accessing how to power down the phone and also access SOS and stuff like that. So it was, I had to go searching for how to hard reboot. So you don't have to. Here's what you do. You press the volume up button, then the volume down button, and then press and hold the side button for about 10 seconds. And I guess this is actually the same for the iPhone 8 and 8 Plus. So it's kind of more like an old, like Nintendo, you know, Konami secret button press thing. So up volume, down volume, press and hold the side button, and then wait for the Apple logo, and that will hard reboot your iPhone 10. What about a screenshot? You hold the side button and the volume up button. That will allow you to take a screenshot. Reachability is now back. So if you swipe down on that home indicator on the bottom, that should activate reachability, assuming that you have it turned on. If you haven't had reachability turned on, go into Settings, General Accessibility, and then turn on reachability, and you will be able to use that gesture. For me, that one's been a little bit tricky to activate, a little bit trickier than it was with the, you know, double pressing the home button when you actually had a home button. If you want to quickly access the notification center, that's pulling down on the left ear or the left horn next to the sensor bar. To access control center, do the same thing on the right side. And then lock screen notifications. This is kind of a cool new feature. They do not show previews of the content. So if a text message comes in or a Twitter alert comes in, what it'll simply show on the lock screen while the screen is locked is just that you have a notification and maybe who it's from. Hey, you have a Twitter notification, but it doesn't actually show the preview of the content. So it kind of maintains your privacy a little bit. I guess this is not new, but it is now the default mode on the iPhone X. And you can actually activate this under iOS 11 on other devices by going into Settings, Notifications, and then look at the Show Preview option, and then enable the When Unlocked option. And if you do that, what that means is when you open up the lock screen, it will not show that data until you've unlocked your device. What's cool about the iPhone X is, of course, with Face ID, the minute it has your attention, those previews immediately show up. And it's kind of a cool effect the first time you use it. So there you go. A couple quick tips on using iPhone X and gestures and things like that. I'm sure there are a ton more. If you've learned a few things with your new iPhone X that you want to share with us, certainly send me an email or an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. All right, I wanted to finish up the day with some things for non-iPhone X users, a few tips and tricks. This time, I want to share with you some tips on using Live Photos. Live Photos is a feature that Apple added to the iPhone starting, I believe, with the iPhone 6S models. So if you have a 6S or newer, you have the Live Photos feature. If you're not familiar with what it is, what a live photo is it looks like a still image in your camera or your Photos app. So you take a photo that's a live photo, and you can tell if you're taking a live photo, if you've taken a live photo, because in the Photos app, it will have a live photo indicator up in the upper right-hand corner. It'll either say live photo or show a little icon that looks like a little sunburst or starburst. Sometimes it's a yellow color. And what a live photo is, it's actually a three-second video that is captured and stored as a separate part of the image file. So you have the static image file, and then you have this three-second video clip that sits combined all in a single file. And that video file is 1.5 seconds before you took the photo and 1.5 seconds after you took the photo. So it's kind of a bracketed three-second video clip. And if you take a live photo on your iPhone in the Photos app and you 3D touch on it, or you tap and hold on some devices like an iPad, what you'll get is a playback of that video. So you'll see the image in the Photos app, and if you 3D touch on it, press or hold on it, it will play the video. And it's actually pretty cool. And you can actually save these things and use them as your lock screen wallpaper, and they'll even work when they're on the lock screen if you have an iPhone 6S or newer. And if you share the photo or share a live photo, typically, if the service doesn't support playback of live photos, what just gets sent out is a regular photo. So you can just kind of use them as regular photos, treat them pretty much the way, same way you would any other photo. But if you have a device that supports live photo or a service that supports live photo, then you also get this extra little video clip, which is pretty cool. And until recently, you couldn't do much more than that with live photos. You could kind of take them and you could view them, but that was about it. And with iOS 11, Apple gave us more control over what we can do with our live photos, including the ability to edit them and get a couple of different effects, more than just playing the video straight through. So I want to start out with how to take and use live photos. Recent versions of the camera app on iOS support it. If your phone supports live photo, live photos will actually be turned on by default in iOS 11. And some people like this and some people don't. So open up your camera app, and right at the top, usually in the middle, you'll see a little yellow, what looks like a starburst icon. That is the live photo icon, and it indicates that live photos are turned on. So if you take a picture while it's in that mode, that photo is going to be a live photo by default. Now, you can disable it by tapping on that little yellow icon and turning it off, and then you just take a regular photo like you always have. Unfortunately, that toggle by default is really only good for that one session. So if you turn off live photo and then you leave the camera app, the next time you come back to the camera app and reopen it, the chances are that the live photo feature will be turned back on. That toggle does not retain its setting by default. Now, fortunately, with iOS 10.2 and greater, Apple added a way to make the setting stick, but you actually need to enable it. You need to go into the settings on your iPhone, go into the camera settings, and look for the preserve settings. Go into that section, and you will see an option for live photo. If you switch that on, then it will preserve the live photo setting in the camera app. So if you toggle it off, it will stay off. If you turn it back on, it will stay on until you turn it off again. So just be aware of that. But that's how you take a live photo. Now, once you have the live photos with iOS 11, Apple added three new effects that you can apply to live photos. And you can also edit the length of a live photo, as well as change the key image that's used for the live photo. That's the static image that will show up when you're looking at it in the Photos app, or when you share it to a service or an application that doesn't support live photo playback. So what you can do is go in the Photos app, and the easiest way to find your live photos inside the Photos app is to go to the Albums section, because your iPhone will have automatically created a live photos album. So you can go into that album, you can see all of your live photos, and then you tap on a live photo, and when you click edit or tap on the edit option, what you'll see at the bottom is a timeline with start and stop endpoints, and you can grab those endpoints. When you do, the timeline will get a yellow outline around it, and you can move those back and forth and change the length of your live photo. You'll also notice a little white box, and that white box indicates which photo is currently your key photo. If you tap on that and drag it, you can change your key photo. And once you let go, there'll be a little dialogue that says make key photo. Tap on that button, and that will change your key photo for that live photo. And you'll see a little dot indicating, a little white dot above the photo that is currently the key photo, and a little gray dot indicating the original key photo if you've made a change. And once you've done all that, you can tap done to save your edits, and then your live photo will retain those. Now, those are non-destructive, so you can always go back in and re-edit that image. And you can change the start and end points, you can change the key photo, and you can also tap to revert everything back to the original live photo as it was when you took it. So first, that's the first thing you can do, edit the content and change the key photo. The other thing you can do is apply different live photo effects. The way you do this is, again, you select the live photo in the Photos application, and then when you're viewing it, where you would normally 3D touch or press and hold to see the live photo effect, which basically just plays that 3-second video beginning to end, swipe up on the live photo, and that will reveal a couple of different effects. You, of course, have live, which is the standard effect. Then there's also a loop, bounce, and a long exposure effect. So loop pretty much does what you might expect it to do. It just continually loops through the live photo. So it plays and keeps playing over and over again. The way bounce works is it plays the live video or the live photo to the end and then plays it backwards back to the beginning and goes back and forth. So it bounces back and forth, playing it forward and then playing it backward, which can create a really kind of cool effect depending upon what the live photo content is. And then the final one is long exposure. This one is not really great for most photos, but if you want to do an effect like, say, light trails, you've taken a live photo of cars at night driving down the freeway or fireworks shooting through the sky, some sort of light moving in a dark background, and you want to get those cool light trails, long exposure can kind of simulate that effect. Another great one is if you do waves or water in the ocean, you can get this kind of misty blur effect that looks really cool in certain situations. Long exposures tend to work best if you've taken the photo using a tripod, or the image is really stabilized where there's not a lot of movement going on, or movement only going on in one area of the photo. So you can play around with that. But it's easy to just tap the effect that you want, and you'll get a preview of it. And you can always swipe up again on that photo to change the effect whenever you want. So you can always change the live photo effect. And the current applied effect will be shown in a little indicator on the live photo. It'll tell you if it's a live photo or a bounce right next to the little live photo icon in the upper left-hand corner of the photo, so you can see what effect is currently applied. And that's about it. That's all the kind of cool stuff that you can do with live photos in iOS 11. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find more information and details on all of their great applications by going to smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. I love your comments, your feedback. Lots of things for you to give me feedback about on this episode of the MacCast. If you'd like to do that, send me an email or an audio comment to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or you can check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/PlusMacCast. But that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.